Welcome to Grid Talk, a series of conversations with the leaders and innovators shaping the 21st century grid. Hosting the podcast is Marty Rosenberg, an award-winning energy journalist. The series is sponsored by the Department of Energy's Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Now, here's Marty Rosenberg with Grid Talk.
Hi, and welcome to Grid Talk. Today, we're very pleased to go north of the border to talk to Sandra Dykeshorn, who's the Vice President of New Nuclear Growth at Ontario Power Generation. And I believe she's based in Toronto. Is that true?
That's right.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the reason we're knocking on your door today is I'm very interested in small modular reactors, and they've had quite a setback in the United States. There was a major project by NuScale, and NuScale has backed off, and they were the lead, the only technology that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States has endorsed. So I'm very interested to learn more about Ontario Power and your plans to start building one pretty soon with a target date of completion by 2028. But before we get into that, talk a little bit about nuclear power in Ontario, which I understand provides half of the province's energy. So it's a well-proven and accepted technology in your part of the world. And give us a flavor of the regulatory environment in Ontario and in Canada for nuclear power.
Sure. Happy to do. So Ontario has the largest amount of nuclear power in Canada. There is about 18 nuclear power reactors in Canada, vast majority in Ontario, one operating nuclear power plant in New Brunswick. There was nuclear power operating in Quebec, but that reactor was put in safe store in 2012. In Ontario, we've had OPG owns and operates two power plants. One is Pickering, just east of Toronto, actually really part of the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, and then Darlington Nuclear Station, which is just a tad further to the east there.
So these two projects are fairly large by U.S. standards. If I read correctly, they have 4,850 megawatts. Is that correct, combined?
The existing stations?
Yes.
So the Pickering is the first nuclear station that was built in Ontario. And they're each roughly about 585 megawatts. So total power output from Pickering is roughly approximately 3,000 megawatts. Darlington is, I probably got the number wrong, but it's roughly in there. The Darlington nuclear station is 1,000 megawatt roughly per unit. So a total of 4,000 megawatts output. So that's the largest CANDU plant. And Bruce Power is slightly different size. So they're all just slightly different generations of the CANDU reactor technology. And together, between Bruce Power and OPG, that's 60% of Ontario's output. And Darlington alone provides 20% of Ontario's electricity on a daily basis.
So you have two that OPG operates and two that you lease to Bruce, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
So originally it was all under Ontario Hydro, and then there was a bit of a breakup, if you will, in the 90s, and Ontario Power Generation was born in 1999. And at the same time, Bruce Power was formed as part of a consortium. And so they lease and operate the lands in Bruce County, and we still own the land and are still very much part of the fabric of that community.
So let's look at the big picture just really briefly. The United States is roughly 10 times Canada in population. We have 90 plus nuclear reactors to your 18. It seems like nuclear power is more accepted in Canada. Would you say that's true? And what would you attribute it to?
Well, I started at Ontario Power Generation in 2016, and the mood publicly, I would say, has shifted a lot in even the past 8 years. And part of that has been driven by climate change and the desire to be building out clean, emissions-free generation options. And there's not really a ton of alternatives when you actually start thinking through the other clean options, all of which are good and needed, but only nuclear can provide baseload electricity 24 hours a day. And I'll give a brief story. Alberta, which is not next to Ontario, but to the west in Canada, has a much greater reliance on coal and gas in particular. It's the dirtiest of the grids in Canada. And they reached a peak demand a week and a bit ago and almost had rolling blackouts. And they had coal and gas operating at maximum that they could, and there was no wind and solar able to kind of step in and help meet the demand on those really cold days. And that's typically what you have in the north, is where you see the greatest demand for electricity is on these extreme weather conditions. And I know you have experience like that, like Texas has had some issues in the United States, but you need to build out an electricity system that can operate for those extreme fluctuations. And so, you know, we've had experiences like that that help drive us to, like, there's really no option to meet net zero without nuclear as part of that solution. And renewables are great, but they're intermittent. And what do you do when the sun's not shining and the wind isn't blowing? And batteries are going to be very much come part of the grid as well, but they're not yet available at scale. And at OPG and in Ontario, we've had great experience for the past almost six decades operating nuclear power safely, reliably, and producing a great amount of electricity. We've gotten rid of all of our coal. The last coal station was closed in 2014, and we no longer have smog days in Toronto. This used to be something that everybody grew up and thought was normal. It doesn't happen anymore because we were able to transition.
Sandra, you've done an excellent job painting the background, which is what I'd hope you do.
Yeah.
But now let's get to the topic at hand. SMR technology has not really taken off in the world yet, even though the technology is fairly understood. According to my checking, as of the end of 2022, just China, Russia, and India had a plant each. Why is it the Western world has not done this yet? And why is Ontario brave enough to be among the first in the Western world to really pursue this with both hands?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why small modular reactors exist at all and why people are investing in this technology is because we know there is a need for smaller, clean, baseload power options that can replace gas and coal. And the war in Ukraine is also really driving the demand for that in Europe. And there's a real desire to get off Russian oil. There's also other geopolitics that factor into not wanting to partner with sort of the non-Western countries. And I think China and Russia and were able to invest. They have obviously significant background in nuclear technologies as well, and probably don't need to tell you or your listeners that. There's been poor experiences with large nuclear buildouts globally, having cost overruns and just challenges with the projects. I mean, you guys have a recent example with Vogtle in Georgia, just coming online. That's very exciting. But that took, it was 10 years delayed. And part of the solution with a small modular reactor is that it's smaller, so that should be quicker to build, doesn't take as long. Additionally, it's more modular and more standardized, so that traditionally large nuclear reactors, you do everything on site, you do all of the construction and everything. And what we're trying to do is introduce factory build out components so that there, it's a little bit more like the oil and gas industry, where you can have ship modules and not everything is being constructed on site. And if something goes wrong, it doesn't pause the whole project. So we're trying to fix some of that. And the more standardized we can make it, the better it is, and the more we'll see deployed. And the reason OPG has the confidence to take first mover position is the experience we've had in managing our Darlington refurbishment project, which is a $12.8 billion project. We're on time and on budget. In fact, we're early. And we expect to bring our last unit on in 2026, and that's essentially taking out all the guts of our CANDU reactor and rebuilding it so we can get another 30 years of life. And the amount of project management and construction and logistics that had to go into planning for that project and the ability that we've shown to deliver has given us the confidence to transfer those skills, and that we have the humans and the talent and the supply chain needed to move forward with small modular reactor build out as well.
Is there anything unique? Let me just bring back something you mentioned a minute ago about we're waiting for batteries to back up intermittent renewable resources. Is there anything unique about that need and the current makeup of the grid that points to smaller nuclear reactors as being more advantageous at this time as opposed to large baseload?
Yeah, I think one of the major differences that typically, whether it's wind, solar, batteries, you're looking at 20-year life. And for nuclear, it's minimum 60 to 70 years that you're going to get out of these plants. And in the case of our Pickering station, we're just awaiting approval from our shareholder, the government of Ontario, to proceed with a refurbishment there that will bring that station to 90 years of life. So yes, it's a higher capital investment at the beginning, but for future generations, like, it's one of those things, like, we have Niagara Falls. I'm sure everybody, all of your listeners are familiar with Niagara Falls. In 1916 or whenever it was built, it was expensive, but it's basically free and it's more than paid for itself. And it's an asset that lives forever if it's properly maintained. And that's, there's a similar value proposition with nuclear.
So just to be clear, the falls weren't built, but you're talking about hydroelectric facilities.
The hydro station. Apologies.
For Americans that are far from that area, must be clear. But my question was, is there anything about small modular reactor technology that makes more sense now than ever before of going small, building smaller units, easier to manage, easier to maintain? Or are they more inherently safe?
Well, the original business case was really around, like, building something that could replace coal and gas. And so batteries aren't that size. Like, you have to build a pretty big battery to replace a coal and gas plant. And then you also need to charge it, so that you're either charging it through, maybe you're pairing it with wind and solar. But again, like, sometimes these batteries have 4, 6, 8 hours. It depends on the battery, but you're not getting 100% output from that battery. And you would with SMRs, and the innovation is now there. Lots of money has been spent, and we're confident at OPG that from a cost perspective, there is a business case that is cost competitive with batteries and renewables that makes a ton of sense for us to move forward with this project.
So where is the plant that's going to be built first? Can you tell us a little bit about it? How close?
Yeah, it's actually right next to our existing CANDU plant at Darlington, which is in Bowmanville, roughly, oh, I should know this, but 30 kilometers roughly from the outskirts of the GTA. And so really ideally located where a major need of electricity is, which is the Toronto area. And it's nice that it's also situated on land that's already an existing nuclear site.
What is GTA?
The Greater Toronto Area. Sorry, that's Canadian lingo.
Okay. So you have the security built in at the site, and they're used to nuclear assets. Is that the advantage?
Yeah, and I mean, we actually started down a path in Ontario in 2008 towards building out a large nuclear station next to that site, and ultimately paused because there wasn't a need for electricity at that time. So it was paused in 2013. Things have obviously evolved and changed as we're moving forward with major decarbonization efforts in both sides of the border. And the need for electricity is very high.
And I assume by putting it there, it mitigates the need for transmission because you have transmission to the area.
There is existing transmission, so that certainly helps as well. And we went through the process of getting an environmental assessment to get ready to build new nuclear, and so that is helpful as well. And we have the community license and social support And we're working very closely with the Indigenous communities as well as we're moving forward through our licensing process. And our hope is that we'll get through that and begin construction of the actual reactor in early 2025.
And when will it be complete, Sandra?
2028, operational 2029.
That's pretty ambitious.
Yeah, well, and that's also the advantage of a small, you shorten the construction time. And so that will be the first reactor, and we're planning to build four at the site.
At the same site.
Same site. And so the same size of reactor as well. So starting with the first one, following a similar model to what we did with refurbishment, which is, you know, I guess make all your mistakes on the first one and then get continually better over each subsequent unit. And the economies of scale you get from building out four there make a ton of sense for OPG. And there's the need for the electricity. So that's why we're moving forward with that.
So what's the estimated cost of all four?
So not released yet. We're still in the midst of finalizing the engineering design. This is a first of a kind deployment. We also have to complete construction. And so a lot of work is going into finalizing that cost estimate. And we expect to release that at the end of this year and move forward into construction.
Do you have any sense of what the cost, this is a technical question, so if you're not prepared to answer it, I understand, but the NuScale project that they were pursuing develop in the United States, originally they thought the power off of it would cost ultimately they canceled it because it went up 50% to $58 per megawatt hour. Do you have any sense whether your projects will be anywhere near that or below that?
I mean, I'm not going to comment on the specifics of the NuScale project. I mean, I think ultimately for them, the challenge was like where that was situated and the need for electricity in that region and the customer base. Like we'll be selling our electricity into the power grid, and there's a definite need for that amount of electricity, and there's a different way in which the cost recovery happens, I think, in both cases. You know, we're confident with our choice with General Electric Hitachi. It's GE Hitachi. It's called the BWX300, and we've done our homework. NuScale was a part of our process and ultimately wasn't in the final three. And ultimately, we chose to move forward with the GE Hitachi design because we felt it was going to be ready technologically first to deploy. And, you know, we've assessed every part of this, including technology readiness, cost, you know, economics and the whole nine yards. And we remain confident that's the right choice.
Could you talk a little bit about the safety mechanism and how any public concerns about the safety of nuclear power will be addressed, and also the nuclear waste question? How will you plan to handle the waste off these four units?
Yeah, so for us, we're planning to manage it in a very similar way that we already do, and we actually don't even call it nuclear waste anymore. We call it nuclear byproducts, and that's because there's a bit of a misnomer that probably the nuclear industry has done to ourselves in calling it waste, because it's actually still almost 90-95% of energy is still remaining in those nuclear fuel bundles. And
there are startups looking at ways of extracting that energy.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and we're staying pretty close to that as well. And there's potential, especially for CANDU fuel, to reuse and reprocess that and put it back on the grid. So the way nuclear power is the only source of electricity where every single part of the life cycle from inception to, you know, decommissioning, safe store, and, you know, how we manage the nuclear byproducts, which we know where everything is, everything's tracked, nothing's getting excreted into the environment. You know, and unfortunately, solar, while wonderful and a great technology, doesn't necessarily have the same story. There's a bunch of chemicals that have to get extracted from the ground. You know, there's a lot of these are being manufactured in China, and they don't have the same kind of environmental regulations that we do here in North America. And you get shipped over here on a barge and we put them on our roofs and we feel really good about ourselves from an environmental perspective, but we're not thinking about the full life cycle cost. And ultimately, they all have to go in a landfill and there's no full decommissioning process. And this is something Alberta is actually thinking about right now, even with orphaned wells that used to be, used for oil extraction, and the companies need to be required in some kind of manner to manage things when they're no longer in use. And so nuclear has a great story to tell, actually, and we're proud of it. And we have rebranded our nuclear byproduct facility to be called Nuclear Sustainability Services. And we're very actively talking about how we do that with the public. And we're not afraid to say that story. And I think that's something the nuclear industry probably hasn't done a great job of.
Okay. And what about the safety question? Is this a next generation safety design? And
yeah.
Take a minute and explain the unique characteristics of the GE product.
Yeah. So essentially, what they're trying to do is remove the humans that need to be involved in managing a nuclear reactor in the event that there's an emergency or something happens. And so ultimately, there's something called passive safety. There's also, you know, wording, NRC uses slightly different wording than the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, but the new NRC is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States. So there's inherent safety and passive safety, but either way, same kind of concept in which, you know, you can kind of have walk away safety and a human doesn't necessarily have to push a button or do anything for 7 days. That's the idea. And it greatly simplifies the management structure, the amount of people required, lowers the overall cost of managing the system. And that's essentially the biggest cost when it comes to nuclear is the amount of humans involved in operating the plant.
So as vice president of new nuclear growth for OPG, OPG does have some operations in the United States, does it not?
Yeah. All hydro. We have a subsidiary called Eagle Creek Renewables, and we purchased that in 2018 along with the company called Cube Hydro, and they merged. And I think there's roughly, the number keeps changing, but I think it's 86 hydro stations, mostly in eastern United States, largely in sort of the Washington, Virginia, Charlotte, like that North Carolina states,
mm-hmm.
But elsewhere in the states as well.
So what I was going to ask you, as new nuclear growth official, can we expect OPG to possibly take this technology into the United States? And is this design getting reviewed by the NRC for possible use in the United States?
It is. And actually, we're partnered with a company called Tennessee Valley Authority, which is based in, well, Tennessee. And they have decided to move forward with the same technology as us. They plan to be a fast follower. They're a sophisticated nuclear operating company already. And what we're doing is cooperating on the technical stuff. And we're also partnering with them with Synthos Green Energy, which is based in Poland. And together, what we're doing is we're working to lower the overall cost for everyone to deploy this technology in our respective jurisdictions. And so OPG is actively working with partners in other parts of Canada. We are actively working with TVA. You know, never say never. There could be all kinds of partnerships that we're willing to explore in the United States. But right now, the nature of our collaboration is mainly with TVA. And then GE Hitachi is based in Wilmington, North Carolina. And we have lots of interface with them as a company as well.
So what's the most exciting aspect of this work? I mean, you're bringing something to market, like I said, that's not really known and used in the free world yet. Do you think this is going to be a real revolutionary development for the power industry in the world, in the United States?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a game changer. I fully, obviously, believe in the technology. I think the biggest piece is ensuring there's the right policy supports with the government to get these first-of-a-kind projects up and running. And, you know, once you get to nth of a kind, you kind of need like the first 2, 3, 4, 5 up. And then you can get to an nth of a kind and really maximize economies of scale. And once you have that, you have a really exciting industry that can look something similar to gas, with a really standardized design and approach that could be deployed all over the world. And so we're really at the front of the pack here. And I think OPG is recognized now globally as a world leader in small modular deployment. and we're being asked how we can help enable deployment in other jurisdictions. And we are figuring that out. We are certainly actively talking to folks in different jurisdictions, particularly in Europe, about whether or not we would consider being an operator and owner in those jurisdictions. But primarily, we're focused on getting this first one done right here and building out a fleet here in Canada. And definitely believe we're part of something big.
So I'm going to be talking to Todd Smith, the Minister of Energy for Ontario.
Oh, good.
What should I ask him about this? And what should I ask him about Ontario's unique embrace of SMR technology?
Well, he's a massive supporter of nuclear energy and real big champion. And actually, you can ask him what Ontario is planning to do in the future as it relates to not only the Darlington nuclear project, but what are they planning to do beyond that project? Because we have a need for doubling the size of the grid, and how nuclear features into that is huge, and what kind of policy supports and frankly financing and work with the federal government, the provincial government can continue to do is critically important for our success, both at Darlington, but also beyond. But I think you'll have a great conversation with him.
Okay. One last question is just to clear up some ideas and make sure everything is clear. Is OPG a publicly owned company? Is it a private company? You mentioned TVA. TVA is technically not a company. It's like Bonneville. It's a public power agency. Tell me, what kind of animal is OPG? And do you have stock owners? And
yeah, so we are set up as a private company. We're actually set up originally to be sold. That was the original intent of the government in 1999. And ultimately, it was stopped for various reasons, which we probably don't have time to get into here. But we have a very sophisticated, independent board of directors with significant nuclear expertise. We have $66 billion worth of assets here in Ontario. We're rated by S&P, Moody's, I'm missing one, DBRS, I believe. And we raise all of our debt in the private markets, well, much of it. And that's something that's happened over the last like 10 years. And we're actively building now a lot of the energy infrastructure here in Ontario. We are owned 100% by the province of Ontario. So Minister Smith, who he'll be speaking with, is our shareholder. And we have obviously a close working relationship with the minister and the province. And they also hold a couple of hats. They're our regulator and energy policy setter as well. But that's the nature of OPG.
Do you think that's a secret sauce here? And this will be my last question. Because in the United States, there's always been a tug of war with the NRC and state regulators and utilities, and people were complaining that the NRC processes were too complicated, they had to be simplified and streamlined. Do you think, I mean, countries like China and Russia, they don't have that. It seems like your situation is fairly unique compared to a lot of investor-owned utilities in the United States. Do you think your situation is kind of like a unicorn unique situation, or do you think this technology is going to rapidly spread to lots of diverse entities like investor-owned utilities?
Oh, I think it's going to spread. I think, like, you know, we have a unique situation, but I don't think it's just based on the politics or the governance. I think it's based on the talent and the skill that we've shown in building out our Darlington refurbishment project. So if we didn't do that successfully, we wouldn't be building SMRs, right? Mm-hmm. So that credibility is something we've built. And whether you're public or private, I don't think it matters. Do you have the right team in place to do this right? And we are partnering with both public sector and private sector. In Saskatchewan, we're working with a public utility, Saskatchewan Power, to deploy SMRs out there. And we announced last week, Monday, that we're working with Capital Power, which is a publicly traded on the TSX, $4.5 billion CapEx company. And they're very motivated to get into the small modular reactor space. And they have numerous assets in the United States. So, you know, I think this is going to rapidly spread. And we have a first mover advantage. And, you know, we have the support from the government to move forward and the credibility to make it happen. And we will get it done.
Thank you, Sandra. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Marty.
We've been talking to Sandra Dykeshorn, who's the Vice President of New Nuclear Growth at Ontario Power Generation. Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, a production of the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Electricity. We regularly convene conversations with thought leaders in the fast-changing electric sector in America and around the world. Please send us feedback or questions at gridtalk@nrel.gov. And we encourage you to give the podcast a rating or review on your favorite podcast platform. For more information about this series, now in its fourth year, or to subscribe, please visit smartgrid.gov.
Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, presented by the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Subscribe through your favorite podcast provider or visit smartgrid.gov for more information.